This is Our American Stories, and we love to tell stories about sports, and so let's get right into it. Because you're about to hear a speech you should have heard, but didn't, maybe a clip or two. We're going to give you the whole thing. It's one of the best speeches I've heard in a long time. And it was given by Brett Favre as he was inducted into the Pro Football Hall of Fame in Canton, Ohio. And Favre, for any of you who haven't lived under a rock, spent 20 years in the NFL as a record-breaking gunslinger with a childlike passion for the game. And there's never been anyone quite like him on a sideline. His career, which included 11 Pro Bowls, 3 All-Pro teams, 3 MVP awards, and NFL records for completions, 6,300, starts, 298, the Iron Man of the NFL, as well as interceptions, my goodness, he had plenty of them, 336, and fumbles, 166, and sacks, 525. He had records for everything, the good and the bad. And that's the thing about Brett Favre, he'd tell you every time, if you ain't throwing interceptions, you ain't throwing. And you got to take risks, and you got to take the consequences with it, and then go back in there and lead the guys again. And it all culminated again, this entire career, with a speech. But by the way, you're limited to only 12 minutes. But he broke this record too, 36 minutes, the longest speech ever at Canton. And as only Favre could do, no one wanted to pull the mic from him. Let's take a listen to it. By the way, the first thing you got to start out with is those crazy Packer fans, because they came in droves. Take a listen to them, because they wouldn't let Brett Favre start. And I've watched a lot of these. I've never seen it happen that long. It was like a minute and a half, and they wouldn't let him start, and everybody's practically crying on the stage. Because the affection this guy and the bond this guy created with his fans, it was unlike anything I've ever seen. But why?
Thank you, Canton. Thank you, Hall of Fame. Thank you, Jesus Christ, my Lord and Savior. Believe me, I'm blessed. I'm an extremely blessed man. I look at my family. What a lucky man. To play a game that I love so much for 20 years, to have all the wonderful things happen, what a blessing. To share in that joy with you guys here tonight, what an incredible night, what an incredible week. And having my wife introduce me was an easy choice, considering she was there long before my first touchdown pass, long after the last.
And then he went on to talk about the first big day in his life that changed his life, his first NFL game, the first one he ever saw, and also, quickly thereafter, the second biggest day of his life, which happened at the hinge and heel of that first day.
December 18th, 1983. I was 14 years old. My dad took my older brother Scott and I to see the last regular season game the Saints would play that year as they were playing the Rams. Now, I was pretty certain at 14 years old of what I was going to do in my future, and that was I was going to be the next Roger Staubach or Archie Manning or Joe Montana. But this was the first and only game that I would ever see in person. And if the Saints won this game, they would have made the playoffs for the first time in franchise history. So it was a pretty electric crowd. And as we sat in our seats prior to kickoff, the crowd stood and they pointed in the direction of the Saints tunnel. And as I stood, I saw this long, gray-haired, scruffy-beard player emerging from the tunnel. And I knew then and there, as goosebumps ran up my arm and the hair on the back of my neck stood up, that that was what I was destined to do and be. I wanted to be that player. Well, that player happened to be none other than Kenny Stabler. I knew that. Of course, I didn't have many choices. It was football, baseball, or bust for me. I didn't have many choices, but I knew then and there that I wanted to be and feel what Kenny Stabler was feeling. What an exciting moment for me. The other part about this story that's important is when we returned home that night, what we didn't know is our mother had set up a surprise birthday party for my older brother, Scott, who was turning 17. Well, I unknowingly entered the house first to a large eruption of surprise, and of course, it was not my birthday. And as you can imagine, a 14-year-old boy in that situation with all his classmates there was red-faced and embarrassed, and I was looking for the quickest way to get to my bedroom. So as I bolted and ducked my head and made my way through all of our classmates, there was one person that caught my eye, and one person only. Well, it didn't matter. I went and hid my room, and as I got up the nerve to come out later, that person and I, we played basketball. We talked. We played basketball. We talked. And several days later, as we used to say back in the day, we started going together. Well, that person happened to be my future wife, Deanna.
And when we come back, we're going to hear more from this speech about his wife, about his kids, but particularly about his dad. Because he spent almost 12 minutes on it. He couldn't get through it. He had to stop a bunch of times. You could tell as the camera kept coming on his family, they were laughing the whole time because he was telling stuff about his dad that most of us today would be appalled at because his dad believed in a sort of old-style tough love. But my goodness, you know one thing. This family believed in it. We might not believe in it now, but boy, the camera didn't lie. Brett Favre's voice didn't lie. And you're going to hear a guy tell a story about his dad and how he couldn't have been anything without him. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories. Brett Favre, and if you're a crying type, get a tissue, because he made the whole place cry. Again, Lee Habib, this is Our American Stories. Brett Favre, his Hall of Fame induction speech. It doesn't get better than this, folks. A little boy from Kiln, Mississippi, a place in the middle of nowhere, becomes world famous. And again, without his dad, it couldn't have happened. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories, and we're celebrating Brett Favre's life, basically, the only way you can, by listening to him say thanks to all the people who'd gotten him where he got. And as you'll learn in this speech, he had a lot to be thankful for. There were a bunch of people along his life without whom he could not have made it. And again, he will let all of us and remind all of us that how we treat other people along their path can make the difference, particularly when we show a belief in another person. Because Brett will tell you, he didn't have much belief in himself. Where he was from, his size, he does not exactly look like an NFL quarterback. He doesn't have that 6'5 Peyton Manning frame. No, sir. But somehow, he had something inside him that people spotted, nurtured, and developed. And that first person, who he just mentioned, the aforementioned woman that he met and played basketball with way into the night, into the next day, and herself, practically a world-class athlete, having survived cancer. Well, you're going to hear the story. His wife survived cancer, and she's now doing Ironman competitions. Pretty tough. And toughness runs in this family. So here's Brett Favre on his wife, Deanna.
By far the strongest and most courageous person I know. She's a wonderful mother of two daughters. An exceptional athlete, not only then, but now, as she most recently is competing in an Ironman in the next 2 months, which is incredible. Definitely a strong woman of faith. She fought cancer in the public eye, and not only won, but she managed to inspire so many, including myself, along the way. She, in the process, she formed her own foundation that has helped countless women in their fight with breast cancer as well. And I'll say this, she's definitely the best-looking grandmother I have ever seen. As our two grandsons are here, Parker and AJ, and I know they're ready to go to bed, and they want Pawpaw to stop talking right now. But one more thing about my wife, she's as beautiful today, and I'm not going to say her age because I got in trouble last year in Green Bay for saying that. But she's as beautiful today as she was December 18th, 1983 in my living room.
Pawpaw kept on talking all right. And after talking about his daughters, he did a shout-out to his mother-in-law. And by the way, how often does that happen, a guy doing a shout-out to his mother-in-law? And listen to Favre choke up talking about this lady.
My mother-in-law, who for 33, 34 years has been by far my biggest fan, I have never thrown an interception that has been my fault, according to my mother-in-law, Ann. We all know her as Momaw. She's helped raise our kids. She's lived with us in New York, in Minnesota, in Green Bay. And she's helped raise grandkids, other people's kids, you name it. She's one of the most patient and loving women you'll ever.
He's choking up here.
Not even halfway through. Help me out here.
And then it was on to his mother, Bonita, and what she taught him about life and about everything else.
My mother, who just recently had her hip replaced, and by no means was she going to be put on waivers for this. She was going to be here. She is here. My mother taught me that being there for your children... My mother taught me that being there for your children is absolutely important. I never, not one time, remember my parents ever not being there at a sporting event, any school function, you name it. They were always there. We ate dinner together. We ate breakfast together. We rode to school together. We did everything together. And that's something that has been lost in this generation. I watched my mother teach special education at Hancock North Central High School for many, many years. And at that time, I didn't appreciate the patience and the type of person that it takes to do that type of job. But I learned by watching her and being around her students that treating everyone as an equal and with respect is not only important but essential. So, Mom, I say thank you. I love you. Mom was the one who always told us she loved us and was a caregiver. And you had to know my father. He was the heavy-handed one. So it was a good blend of 1-2 punch. But, Mom, I love you, and thank you so much.
And, again, Favre time and again stumbled here. We sort of cut out much of that. And one thing that you got to know, he had no script here. Most of these guys come on pretty scripted. Favre just swung it like he did when he pulled back in the huddle. I mean, there was a play. But what made Favre great always is what happened when the play broke down. You almost got the sense he wanted it to break down. Because in chaos, this guy was just great. And the defense didn't know what to do because he knew how to extend a play. And yeah, there'd be some interceptions. But the thrill of watching him in that chaos is, I think, what Packer fans loved about him. And he didn't just dump the ball away like a lot of quarterbacks would and not take the risk. And that warrior spirit in him is why you keep hearing those fans. And this emotional intimacy that you hear, this sort of raw sort of masculinity that has an emotional side, it's a rare thing that you hear a jock talking like this. And he was always like this. And you'd see him on the sidelines hugging guys and tapping them on the butt and encouraging them and yelling at them and loving on them. And he just, you couldn't get enough of him. And guys loved playing for and with Brett Favre. Here he is on his brothers and his sisters.
My two brothers, Scott and Jeff, my sister Brandy, they're sitting here in the front row. I think they all would agree. I love them so much. It was definitely a fun childhood. We competed, we fought, we ate, we competed, we fought, we ate. We loved each other at the end of the day, and we got up the next morning and we started it all over again. But it was wonderful, and I wouldn't trade it for anything. And I love you guys so much. Thank you.
We competed, we fought, we ate. We competed, we fought, we ate. We loved one another. And then we got up all in the morning and did it all over again. My goodness, what a great childhood. What a lucky guy. And what a lucky guy to grow up where he grew up with the family he grew up at the time he grew up. This is Lee Habib. This is Brett Favre in his own voice talking about his life, giving thanks. And by the way, we like to share those kind of stories with you because you don't hear them anywhere. This is a clip and then you go to the murder and the mayhem. But this is real life. This is how we all try and live our lives. And Brett Favre did his best to lead with joy, with passion. And again, it's why all those Packer fans trekked to Canton, Ohio. And I mean, they filled the stadium with them. They had to do it in an outdoor stadium. I never saw anything like it. And Brett, well, he knows Packer fans, so he wasn't surprised. When we come back, we told you he was going to tell us about his dad. He did. You're going to hear it. And much more. You're going to hear about his coaches, too. All of them. Because he names all of them. And then the players. Because he calls them all up and he calls them out by name. And they're all smiling. Every single one of them made it. All of them made it. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories. Brett Favre's story. In his own words. After these messages. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. Brett Favre's Hall of Fame speech in Canton, Ohio. We're bringing it all to you. I didn't have the heart to edit any of this out. Who the heck am I to do that? Who the heck is this team to do that? I couldn't stop watching the whole thing. So that's why we bring these things to you. Because my goodness, this just pumped me up by the time it was over. I was crying, but a really good cry. And you watch the people walk out like they just left a great concert. You could just watch the audience rushing out and then these fireworks. And you watched all the athletes coming together like you hadn't seen. And Favre's back slapping all of them. And he's just one of those guys. One of those guys. And then it was his dad. And he starts off by telling the story of the day he found out his father died. He had a game in Oakland. And he played that game because he knew his dad would have wanted him to. Don't abandon the team. And sort of a military ethos. And so he honored his father's legacy by playing that game. And it ended up being the greatest performance of his life. And the whole country watched it knowing what had happened. And the Oakland fans, by the way, are not known for being gracious. But the ovation they gave him and the players and the respect they afforded him was really remarkable. You don't see it in sports. You don't equate grace in sports that often. But he won in Oakland and was flying back to Mississippi for the funeral with his bride and with friends. He was given a special escort by the Oakland police, and a special plane was chartered by some friends. And here he is talking about that tough flight back home to bury his dad.
On our flight back, it was a long flight, and as you can imagine, there was a lot of emotions. As we had just won the game, and it was probably the best game that I'd ever played in, but that really didn't matter at that point. And we laughed, we cried, we tried to sleep. We laughed and we cried. And one time in particular, Deanna says to me, and you'd had to know my father. My father was short on praise and long on tough love. If he was ever to praise me, I was not to hear it. It was always, you can do better. He was always pushing me to be better. That was okay. Never did I hear him say, son, you've arrived. You're the best. That was awesome. Great game. It was always, yeah, but. So Deanna says to me on the plane, you know, your dad had said to me that he had hoped or could not wait for the day that you were inducted into the Hall of Fame so he could introduce you. And up until that moment, I had never thought about the Hall of Fame. And I mean no disrespect to the Hall of Fame. I say this with the utmost respect for all you guys. I had dreamed of playing the NFL, believe me, way more than I thought about my schoolwork. I thought about being Archie Manning, running around throwing underhand passes. I thought about being my childhood favorite, Roger Staubach, throwing it to Preston Pearson or Drew Pearson, handing it off to Tony Dorsett, being Kenny Stabler coming out of the tunnel. I'd thought of those things so many times, but I never thought of the Hall of Fame until that moment. And so a new goal had entered my mind then and there. And I said to myself, I will make it to the Hall of Fame.
And his father was a coach. And here he is talking about that dimension and that aspect of their relationship.
He taught me toughness. Boy, did he teach me toughness. Trust me, there was no room for crybabies in our house. He taught me teamwork. And by all means, no player was ever more important than a team. And my father, for those who don't know, chose to run the wishbone, which some of you younger generation people do not even know what that is, but it never entailed throwing. But that was the type of coach he was, and that was the type of dad he was. He would never showcase his son's talents or anyone else's talents for their good rather than the team's good. And so then and there, in that moment on that plane, I was determined, for selfish reasons, to get to this point, to acknowledge how important he was. I would not be here before you today without my father. There's no doubt whatsoever.
And one last story about his dad. And never underestimate the importance of being there for your boy.
One more thing about my father, and this is something I've never told anyone, including Deanna. My dad was my high school football coach. He was the head football coach. He coached me and my two brothers. But I never had a car growing up. I always rode to and from school with my father in his truck, and so he was always the last to leave the building because he had to turn the lights off, lock up, and then we made our way home. So it was the last high school football game of my high school career, and although I don't remember how I played before, and I don't remember how I played in the last game, what I do remember is sitting outside the coach's office, say on a Wednesday, waiting for my father to come out so we could leave. It was dark, and I overheard my father talking to the three other coaches, and I heard him, and I assume I didn't play as well the previous week only because of what he said. And he said, "I can assure you one thing about my son. He will play better. He will redeem himself. I know my son. He has it in him." And I never let him know that I heard that. I never said that to anyone else. But I thought to myself, that's a pretty good compliment, you know. My chest kind of swole up. And I never told anyone. But I never forgot that statement, that comment that he made to those other coaches. And I want you to know, Dad, I spent the rest of my career trying to redeem myself. I'm working on it. I'm trying to get through it. But I spent the rest of my career trying to redeem myself and make him proud. And I hope I succeeded.
And then he just had to take a break, as you could tell. And we all did. I got to tell you, the set, when it came back to ESPN, every single guy is crying. Every single guy. Anyway, then he goes on to thank a lot of other people. And you're going to get to this part of the speech. And it's all these strangers, these coaches, who just love on him. But tough love. They wanted to see the best Brett Favre he could be. And I think too often we're, look, I love our country, I love our people, and I love our parents. But I think sometimes we go overboard in effusive praise of our kids. We're creating entitled children. And maybe his dad went the other extreme and didn't say, I love you enough. But my goodness, listen to that. Listen to it. And listen, you had to see the pictures of the family members and the friends and the pride he had in his dad and the pride his dad had in him. And the performance he got out of his son. He got the best out of his son. And in the end, his parents, that's our job. I mean, we got to love our kids. We got to love them enough to sometimes discipline them. And Brett Favre's dad was not afraid to do that. The mom provided the love. The dad provided the discipline. As he put it, it was a great blend. And it worked for him. And when we come back, we're going to hear about those other men in his life, the coaches who believed in him and gave him a shot. And in the end, one man, one businessman who gave him a shot in the NFL when no one else thought he should be there. And again, Favre will break down one or two more times here. But it's raw, and it is real. And we all did with him, those of us who watched it. And when we come back, more with Brett Favre, his gratitude evident, his love evident, the Canton Hall of Fame speech that we're bringing to you here on Our American Story, celebrating the career of Brett Favre in Brett Favre's words. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories, and our final segment and installment of Brett Favre's great speech at the Pro Football Hall of Fame in Canton, Ohio. A 20-year career in the NFL, he smashed every record, the good ones and the bad ones. 11 Pro Bowls, 3 MVP awards, and in this particular part of the speech, he went on to thank some of his coaches, and one in particular was special. And it was a coach at Southern Miss. He didn't get picked by any of the big programs. He got only one scholarship offer. And it wasn't an SEC school right up the road, right here in Oxford, Mississippi, Ole Miss. No, it was little old Southern Miss in Hattiesburg.
There are two coaches in particular that were at Southern Miss at the time that meant more than anyone. Mark McHale was offensive line coach, and Mark was the recruiting recruited the area of the Mississippi Gulf Coast in which I played. And he fought tooth and nail to get me a scholarship, and it came down to the last hour. And when I say last hour, I literally mean last hour. And he fought, and he believed in me, and I thank him so much. And he's coaching high school football back in West Virginia, probably watching right now. So, Coach, I thank you so much for believing in me and sticking it out and giving me that opportunity. And the second coach is a guy who has since passed away, and his name is Thamus Coleman. And as we called him back then, Famous Thamus, was a great guy. And I found out this story, this was a story that Ron Wolf would later tell me after I started playing in Green Bay. Well, he came down after my senior year to watch film of my senior season. And I believe Ron at the time was with the Jets and was looking for a quarterback. And he, after he watched his film of my senior year, upon leaving the building, Thamus Coleman said, "Well, Ron, what did you think?" And Ron Wolf said, "Not that impressed." We said, "I'm not sure if you know, Brett had a really bad car wreck right before the start of this season. He lost 34 inches of his intestines. He fractured a vertebrae in his back. Not only was he not supposed to play, we didn't think he would. And he suffered other injuries as well. But he did start 4 years for us, and I encourage you to go back in and watch the three previous years." Well, Ron Wolf took his advice and went back in and watched the film. And upon leaving, Thamus Coleman said, "Well, what did you think?" And as I like to say, the rest is history.
Without that coach going the extra yard, there goes Brett Favre's NFL career. And then it took one businessman, Ron Wolf. He was the GM of the Packers, the man who turned the Packers around. And one man, one woman can always make a difference, folks. In fact, they almost always do. And when he takes over, he brings in this young guy named Brett Favre. And here is Brett talking about the general manager. And you don't hear athletes talk about GMs like this.
Ron Wolf is the single most important person to the Packers' rebirth than any other person out there. Player, coach, GM. It had been almost 25 years since the Packers had had any success when Ron Wolf took over. And since then, we all know what the Packers have done. Without Ron Wolf, Mike Holmgren would not have coached in Green Bay. There would not have been a Brett Favre. There would not have been a Favre to Sharp and Driver and Brooks, Freeman, Chimura, Keith Jackson, Dorsey Levens, Edgar Bennett, Frank Winters, Santana Dotson, Andre Wright. The list goes on and on. The single biggest free agent acquisition in NFL history is Reggie White. And as I like to say, Ron Wolf made it cool to come to Green Bay. So I thank you, Ron, for believing in me, seeing something in me that others didn't see, probably including myself, and sticking your neck out there for one of the riskiest and craziest trades in NFL history. When you decided to trade a first-round pick for me with Atlanta. So I say thank you, Ron. I love you. You mean more to me than anyone.
And he said it a few times. These people stuck their neck out for him, and they believed in him. So anytime you get a chance and you can stick your neck out for someone and then follow that up with some real belief, oh my goodness, you can change a life, folks. Here's Brett Favre on Coach Mike Holmgren.
The man he hired, Mike Holmgren, the greatest head coach I've ever played for. I see him sitting with my good friend Matt Hasselbeck. We both can attest he's one of the toughest and most demanding coaches you will ever be around. He's a true perfectionist, and I'm sure Steve and Joe would say the same thing. But he was a very fair guy, and I know that because could you imagine being Mike Holmgren, and leaving San Francisco. Tremendous success, coaching two of the greatest players of all time, Joe Montana and Steve Young, and getting stuck with Brett Favre. Now, I thought I was good, but I had no idea what good was. And I am so thankful that Mike chewed my ass, but believed enough in me to give me another chance. Because there were many times he could have and should have pulled me. And had he done that, there's probably someone else standing here before you talking. So I'm thankful, Mike, for you and believing in me.
I thought I was good, but I had no idea what good was. And look at the gratitude he has for this man, that while he was going through that crucible, he had to be cursing Mike Holmgren every other day. Do you know who I am? I'm Brett Favre. And Holmgren just right back in his grill. Right back in his grill. You can do better. But never taking him off the field. Wow. He then asked the players who he played with to stand up, and they all showed up. It was a testimony to Favre's leadership talents.
I want the guys that I play with to stand up. I'd love to call each and every one of you out by name. And this is college, too. If there's one, stand up. If there's 100, stand up. I love you guys. I love you. Let me tell you, and this may not be a secret, I love playing with you guys. It was a blast. I love carrying you off on the fireman carry. I love tackling you. I love slapping Marco in the ass. I loved it. I loved it. And he loved it too. And for everyone up here, they would all agree that's what it's all about. Not necessarily slapping them on the ass, but loving your teammates, competing, fighting, scratching, tough losses, tough wins. Man, that's what it's all about.
And in the end, he closed it out by talking about the things he was most proud of. Here's Brett Favre closing out one of the great speeches ever at Canton.
What I'm most proud of, what I think about most, has nothing to do with statistics. Although, who would have ever thought that a young man from Kill, Mississippi, whose father ran the Wishbone, would hold every passing record in NFL history at one time? Pretty doggone amazing, if you ask me. But that's not what makes me most proud. What makes me most proud is how I played the game and being real, authentic, and spontaneous, and loving the game. To me, is what it was all about. I couldn't believe that they paid us and that I was racking up statistics like I was. I was just having fun, and I'm most proud of that. And so when I look back over my 20 years, I can honestly tell you, I can't tell you a lot, but I can honestly tell you that I hold no regrets. Did we win every game? No. Did I make every throw? No. Did I make mistakes? More than I care to count. But I can say this, there was never one time where I did not give it all I could. You know, and I've said this to my daughters, and I say it to any young person out there who is playing sports. Don't ever look back and regret not doing your best. Don't ever look back, because there are no second chances. When you're 25 and you wish you would have done something in high school, it's too late. Don't cheat yourself. Don't cheat your teammates. Work as hard as you possibly can. Lay it all on the line, and whatever happens, happens. But you won't look back and regret. I don't regret anything. It's not to say it was perfect. I don't regret anything, and that's what I'm most proud of. And I say thank you again.
You know, most people fail out of self-sabotage. They just don't give it their all. some self-doubt, something, some upbringing, who knows what. And Favre's a lucky man. His dad taught him how to give his all. His mom taught him how to keep that human nature and not let the competitive instinct overwhelm everything. Love and surrender. And he did both so well. And that's what people loved about Brett Favre. He surrendered everything on that field, and yet he did it with love. The best of the masculine and feminine, and whatever either of those things even mean anymore. It was all there. This is Lee Habib. Brett Favre's extraordinary speech, pretty much unedited. For you, this is Our American Stories. Habib, and this is Our American Stories, where we tell stories about everything, music, life, love, the arts, and of course work, because it's such an important part of our lives. And that leads us also, sometimes, to talk about public policy, but only as it impacts workers and business owners. And this story goes to, well, the roots of a real problem. And I say roots because we're talking about hair, and actually the roots of a nation here. And the idea that men and women should be able to make a living free from excessive government interference. Why am I talking about hair? Tennessee recently passed a law that requires a license to do as a job what most of us do every day. We grow up doing it and sometimes do it for our children and our aging parents. But now this job requires a cosmetology license, which costs $35,000. And that job is washing hair. Occupational licensing, by the way, is what we're going to be talking about. But before we get into that, I wanted to have you join us, Tammy. Tammy Pritchard, a full-time police officer who is suing the state of Tennessee to be able to wash hair part-time because she can't afford to get that aforementioned license. Tammy, thanks for joining us.
Hi, how you doing today?
I'm very good, and how are you?
All right.
Tammy, tell me a little bit about your life, your family, and your childhood before we get into this seemingly crazy story about you and the state of Tennessee.
I started out in the beauty shop working like with my sister and her friends. My sister was a natural hair care, but she had friends that was cosmetologists. So I would go in and help them during the summer and, you know, during school times when I get out of school, washing hair for friends, you know, to just make a little extra money. And then it also helped the beauticians where they could just, you know, go on and continue to do other clients. So that was a good income for, you know, a teenager like me, young teenager. And then after that, I, you know, became a young parent, a young mother with three sons. So they even helped me as that. And then doing that, shampooing, and then I did college part-time and still raising my three sons. So it was a great income.
It was a great income, and, you know, you're being a little humble here. Your sister, by the way, Deborah Nuttall, I hope I'm pronouncing your name right, she pioneered the natural hair movement for African-American women and has a natural hairstyling salon as well. I mean, this is something that's been in your blood, your DNA, and your family for a very long time.
For years. My oldest son is going to be 20. Well, I'm going to go back to her oldest child. Her oldest child, like 30-something years old, so she was doing that way even before she had her first child. So we've been doing it for 30-something years or plus. So,
yeah, this is what you do. And, you know, it's interesting. Yeah. You said that washing hair, you know, helps pay some bills. But, you know, we're talking about some important bills, Tammy, like covering your health care expenses.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And it helped me take care of my three sons. I was able to get my first little car. It helped me with being a young parent and a young lady to go through school, college. So it helped. It did a great deal for me and a lot of other young friends that I know that wanted to be beauticians, that it helped them also. So when they came in with that law, it really hurt a lot of us. And my thing was They wanted us to get off of welfare. They wanted the young women off welfare, but you come in and take from us and put us back on welfare.
Yeah, and you have this happen to you, and what's your turn? What do you do next? Tell us the story. So the state says you can't do this anymore. Where do you get the gumption to sue the state? How did you get to that? And by the way, congratulations for having the courage to do that, Tammy.
Well, I was really upset about it, and I just sat back and thought about it. And me and my sister, she was upset about it. And so we sent out letters, and we talked to the board and everything, and they still, like, it was just none and void that they didn't hear us. And fortunately, God heard our cry, and he sent the Beacon Center to go and talk to someone else, and they gave my sister name. And then my sister gave my name. And so that's how we end up getting with the Beacon Center, that they said that they would help us. So that's how we end up.
And we'll be talking to Braden Busek from the Beacon Center in the next segment. We wanted to talk to the legal aspect of this, but before we did that, Tammy, we wanted to dig into the personal aspect, because the personal, sadly, here became the legal through no fault of your own. So let's talk about the penalty. It turns out that penalty, I almost can't believe I'm going to read this sentence. Penalty for shampooing without a license is 6 months in jail or a $500 fine, Tammy. And by the way, we know you're not going to prison, but $500 for each offense?
Right.
This pretty much is a deterrent to you trying to do your job.
Right. And so there still is a lot of people that, especially like you had like a lot of young girls doing that in the shop, helping their aunties. So if you come in and you said, give them 6 months, like me, I was a college student. If I would have been doing it, you would have messed up my college career, because you're going to send me to jail just because I was washing hair. I'm going to go to jail, or I'm going to have to pay $500.
Yeah. And by the way, in my notes here, there's no school in Tennessee which offers classes in shampooing.
At all.
Well, this is, Tammy, thank you for doing what you did. Thank you for taking this case and making it public, being a voice for this case, fighting for your rights. And, this is just one of those things and one of those stories where you just go, there's got to be a reason. And so when we come back on the other side of this break, oh, my goodness, there's got to be a reason, right? Well, we're going to talk.
Yes, we do.
Well, we're going to talk to Braden Busek from the Beacon Center of Tennessee. And he's going to walk us through what's really going on with this law, why it came into being, and why he and the folks at the Beacon Center are standing up and fighting in the public square and in the courts for Tammy and so many of the women. And it is mostly women, and it's mostly African-American women this is attacking, and a lot of low-income women. And we're going to get some answers from Braden Busek and the fine work they're doing over at the Beacon Center of Tennessee. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories. And this is Our American Stories. And we just heard a story that seems pretty un-American, actually. Tammy Pritchard being denied her opportunity to wash hair, something she and her family know a lot about, something she'd been doing all her life. And I can only assume there weren't customer complaints from her hair washing that caused the government to come in here and do this. And I can't imagine that there was any mass complaint to the federal government or the state government about this mass crisis with hair washers needing to be regulated. And so joining us to talk about this and where this sprang from, well, we had to bring on Braden Busek from the Beacon Center of Tennessee, whose tagline is empowering Tennesseans to take control of their own lives and their own vision of the American dream. And we love that tagline. Thanks so much for joining us, Braden.
It's my pleasure, Lee. Thanks for having me on.
You bet. What's going on here? Just give us an idea of where this law was coming from, because it could not have possibly come. And I'm not a betting man, but I would bet everything I own that this did not come from complaints from civilians about bad hair washing.
If it did, we have found no evidence of it. We've done a good bit of research into trying to ascertain the actual harm that unlicensed shampooing could pose to consumers, and we can find minimal evidence, really debatably no evidence, that this was in any way a harm to consumers. There really is takes place against a backdrop of a larger issue, which is the scourge of occupational licensure requirements, which is literally permission from the government just to work. The numbers on it are pretty staggering. In the 1950s, there was something like 1 in 20 Americans needed a license to work. Those tended to take place in fields like doctor, dentist, lawyer, accountant, and so on. But in 2016, the number is closer to, I think it's 1 in 3 or 1 in 5. It's down in that area. And this despite the fact that more Americans work in fields that are service-oriented and ostensibly should be safer.
Right. And so then the question comes, you know, where does this law come from? And I can think of two reasons, Braden, and let's spend some time on both of them. The first could be it's a straight revenue play. The state needs the money. It could also be an anti-competitive play. Somebody who is in a certain business wants to block other people from competing with them, so they raise the barriers to entry. And what we mean by that, that's economic speak for saying we're making it too expensive for you to compete with us by only allowing a price tag that some bigger business could absorb. Talk about those two possibilities, and which one do you think is at work, or both?
Well, we allege that both of them are at work. And, you know, you mentioned it before about the schools. You know, if you study the licensure regime close up, you'll see that the state goes to great lengths to regulate and specify that you have to get a license. It even tells the students right down to the very kind of kit that they need to buy from the schools. But as far as regulating the actual curriculum of the schools or requiring that a school teach the curriculum, they don't appear to be particularly concerned about that. So you can easily come away with the impression that all of this is about generating fees for the state itself and the schools. And to your other point, which has to do about protecting consumers, yes, I mean, economic protectionism is unfortunately something that we allege is afoot here. The evidence of it is all over the place. I think most people agree that this is something that their children do safely at home, is shampoo their own hair. There's really not a valid safety reason, but it is a way to deliver benefits to existing market participants. I think an interesting statistic that we uncovered is the Bureau of Labor actually keeps wage statistics for the shampooing field.
Yep.
And would you care to guess which two cities in America have the highest wages per hour for shampooing?
Nashville and Memphis.
Bingo.
How about that? I'm pretty good, huh?
Yeah, you are. So the average per hourly wage for washing hair in Tennessee is $15 an hour. And the next highest state, according to the Bureau of Labor, is New Jersey, and it's in the $10 range.
Wow. And let's think about or talk about this vague licensing requirement. We have here a couple of the things that you're going to get in the 300 hours of instruction. 300 hours of instruction. They want to have you learn about the theory and practice of shampooing. They want classes in draping a client in a clean towel, brushing hair in 1-inch segments, and how to clean up blood, how to answer a phone properly, how to order a product, the composition of shampoos, and OSHA requirements. This is almost Stalinistic, isn't it?
Stalinistic is one term. To me, I think it just looks like pure busy work. I mean, I think you'd be hard-pressed to come up with 300 hours of curriculum relevant to shampooing. I mean, it's an expression, right? Lather, rinse, repeat.
Yep.
that's all it is. And we all do it safely to ourselves or, in many cases, a family member throughout our lives. So, I mean, you know, if you think about it, the vast majority of that list actually has nothing to do with shampooing. You know, like Tammy was telling you, I mean, she just wants to wash hair. She doesn't care about answering the phone or running a store. Why does she have to know how to order product, let alone OSHA regulations? It's just busy work designed to give students.
Do the schools have their own lobbyists pushing this? Because I've got to think that this, I'm thinking of interested parties. Who benefits, who loses? I'm always thinking about winners and losers when the government gets involved, because every time they do, they create a winner and a loser. We know who the loser is. Who's the winner?
Well, as it currently stands, since it is so difficult to become a shampooer, the big beneficiaries are, of course, people who have the license now, and furthermore, cosmetologists themselves, because cosmetologists are allowed to wash hair. And if shampooers could do that practice standing alone, that would eat into the profits of licensed cosmetologists. I think Tammy told me at one point in time, and I'd want to ask her, but I think she said that working part-time as a shampooer in a salon, she would get about $20 a hair wash of what the cosmetologist brought in for the service as a whole. That's really not bad money.
No. Not bad at all. A lot of Americans would be nodding going, I'll take that, especially a lot of stay-at-home moms or stay-at-home dads. I mean, you're going,
sure.
Wow, that's nice. It's part-time. I get to meet people. I get to have some nice conversations, nice atmosphere. It's always a friendly atmosphere. Every time I go to the barbershop, I go, what a nice place to have a nice conversation, a nice, decent place to have a part-time job. Tell us about the lawsuit against the state of Tennessee. What are you suing for, and how's it going?
Well, we've alleged that a number of allegations. We've alleged, first and foremost, that this violates the right of Tennesseans to pursue what's called economic liberty, that the pursuit of the American dream is, in fact, a constitutional right. You have a right to choose and select your career. I personally would tell you I think that the founders would consider it unrecognizable that in a court of law, something all like the things that are recognized as constitutional rights, anything from abortion to same-sex marriage to virtual child pornography, lap dances, all of those things are, according to the courts, constitutionally protected. Yet if you say, I want to have and hold a good job, that's not accorded constitutional significance. And I think that's just completely upside down. And so we allege that this violates her constitutional right to economic liberty. Separately, we also allege Tennessee's got a really interesting constitutional provision. It's called an anti-monopolies provision, and it's in our equivalent of the Bill of Rights. But what it reads is, and get this, monopolies and perpetuities are contrary to the genius of a free state and shall not be allowed.
Wow, be still my heart. Love it.
Yep, that's written in our Constitution. Now, our courts haven't always behaved that's in our Constitution, and it doesn't get a whole lot of attention. But really, this is a state-sanctioned monopoly. Nobody else can do it unless you have the license, and currently it's difficult, if not impossible, to get that license. As you may or may not know, last year, about a year ago, the U.S. Supreme Court issued an opinion dinging the North Carolina Dental Board for characterizing teeth whitening as a practice of dental medicine. And in ruling, they observed that the board of dentists was comprised almost exclusively of dentists.
Yep.
And they said that that's really not state action. What you've got there is anti-competitive activity. And for purposes of the Sherman Antitrust Act, you can't claim state immunity. You're not acting as a state. You're just acting in an anti-competitive fashion.
You bet.
And we think that precedent is directly applicable here. The only difference being is this is a constitutional right in Tennessee.
Well, good luck with this. And with 30 seconds left or so, Tammy, if you were to be able to talk to the governor face-to-face, what would you ask him and why, real quickly?
I would ask them, why did they make that a law to make shampoo go do 300 hours? And I want to know why did you take that from us? That something that was helping us economically to be able to take care of our families, and it was a good living. It wasn't bad, And I wanted to know why would they take that from us.
Well, we're going to ask him. Actually, we're going to take this clip and we're going to call him up, and we're going to ask him. And thanks so much for what you do, Tammy, and what you're doing, and Braden, and the folks at the Beacon Center. Thanks for fighting the fight, not only for Tammy, but for countless other women and men who simply want to be able to make a living without the encumbrance of the state throwing senseless rules and regulations at them. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories. To hear all of these stories, go to OurAmericanNetwork.org. That is OurAmericanNetwork.org. We'll be right back. is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories, and you're listening to the unique voice of Jerry Garcia. And on this day in history, in 1995, Jerry Garcia passed. And I'd been to any number of Grateful Dead shows. I could not call myself a big fan until I actually went. I was a big Bob Dylan fan. I went to see Dylan open for the Dead. And Bob Dylan didn't open for anybody. So if he wanted to submit himself to going on the road with the Grateful Dead for a while, and Tom Petty had, and all of my heroes had, I thought, I'm missing something. And so I dragged myself to the Dead, and then I got it. I figured it out. And they were one of those bands you had to go see to understand. Their records are sometimes incomprehensible, but their live performances weren't. And he was an American musician best known for that lead guitar work, singing and songwriting in this band that everybody had an opinion about. And though he disavowed the role, Garcia was viewed by many as the leader or spokesman of the group. But he didn't ever want to be considered that. It's just that the media had to have somebody to appoint as that role, and so they did. And it was just 8 days after his 53rd birthday. He was found dead in his room in a rehabilitation clinic, the cause of death, a heart attack. The Dead was formed in 65 in Palo Alto, California. The band is known for its unique and eclectic styles. Fused elements of country, folk, bluegrass. You heard a reggae beat in the entry song. Rock, jazz, psychedelic, space rock. All of it to appease a multi-ethnic crowd that followed him. And it wasn't just, in the end, it wasn't just white folks. I remember seeing Santana open for the Dead, one of my favorite guitar players, and I think one of the greats of all time, who just loved and worshipped the ground the Dead walked on. And seeing that show, you saw a very different Grateful Dead than seeing Willie Nelson, who I adore, touring with the Dead. So everybody wanted to tour with this band. Jerry's ancestors on his father's side were from Spain. His mother's ancestors were Irish and Swedish. He was born in San Francisco on August 1st, 1942. And now we're going to play you some clips from the man himself, as we so often do. We just played again the Frank Sinatra Hour, where we heard from Frank in his own words about his life, the boy from Hoboken who never saw himself making it in the big city and finally getting to sing New York, New York, owning the joint. Here, Jerry Garcia was asked a question you often hear in interviews with musicians. What were your early influences? Garcia goes on to reluctantly answer that question.
Do you really want to hear that? Well, I had eclectic influences, let's put it that way. I heard virtually every kind of music. My father was a musician, you know. My mother was a coloratura, you know, soprano, and I heard every kind of music. My grandmother loved country music, the Grand Ole Opry, and Harry Owens and his Royal Hawaiians. I mean, I heard all kinds of things. My ears were full of music, you know. So plus the popular music of the time, the 40s and 50s, you know, when I was growing up. But I was at the inception of rock and roll. I listened to rhythm and blues. I had an older brother who was a rhythm and blues nut, and so I got rhythm and blues from him. And then rock and roll, as it developed in the 50s, was like my music. That was my native music, so to speak. And that was the thing that made me want to play. Was rock and roll the first thing I heard when I heard the electric guitar and Chuck Berry and all the great, you know, licks, the rock and roll licks, and just the sound of the electric guitar. I thought, God, I really want to do that. And I got my first electric guitar when I was 15, and that was it.
And that was it. Garcia goes on to explain more on his early musical influences that went from playing the banjo to listening to the Beatles.
The first thing I got really serious about, in the sense of being rigorous, was the five-string banjo, and I heard bluegrass music, and that got to be something very important to me, and so I swung off into that for 4 or 5 years, and really started to work hard at the five-string banjo, and that's where I slowed records down, and you know, I wanted it to sound exactly right, you know, not just approximately right, and I did that for a while. And then the rock and roll wave came up, you know, with the Beatles and stuff like that. And hey, that looks like it'd be fun to do. And besides, I know this music, you know. And so having a preference for the kind of more like the Chicago sound, the blues sound, the Marshall Chess sound, that sort of thing, our band, when we started a band, it was kind of more like the Rolling Stones, say, insofar as it was that kind of music.
And here, Jerry Garcia talks about how the Grateful Dead formed as a collection of friends who could play, and a frontman, Ron Pigpen McKernan, on keyboards, harmonica, and vocals.
The Grateful Dead is really a collection of friends, people that were around at the time, and who played some. You know, I mean, not everybody was really. When the Grateful Dead first started, we were called the Warlocks. We had one strong suit. We had Pigpen in the band, and he was this guy from Palo Alto whose father had been a rhythm and blues disc jockey. So for him, the blues was very natural, and he played harmonica, and he sang really well, you know. And he really had no real wish to be a performer. We sort of forced him into it because we knew he could do it. And so he was kind of the front man for the band. He was our powerhouse guy, and the rest of us could play better than him, but he could sing better than or anybody else. So he got to be the front man for the band.
And Garcia goes on to explain how in the early days of the Dead, they ended up playing so many local shows in the Bay Area, they were all able to quit their day jobs.
We ended up kind of playing the divorcees clubs up and down the Bay Area, you know, down the peninsula and East Bay and San Francisco. We ended up playing Broadway in San Francisco, which was about as far as you could go as a band in those days, you know. We were working for the local agent, the guy that booked all the bands in the Bay Area, and worked with the union, this guy did. His name was Al King, and he used to book the strippers and dog acts and magicians and anything you can think of, you know. He was like the guy in the Bay Area. And so we were doing that. That was our circuit. We played, typically we played six nights a week, five sets a night. That was what we did. We just did it and did it and did it. And then we got good doing it. I mean, it was a great way to get good. And we were young enough to love it, you know. And it was also, we made enough so we could quit our day jobs, you know. That was what we did. That happened immediately.
Yeah, it didn't happen immediately, but my goodness, what an opportunity. And later on, they would go on to sell countless number of records, and ultimately in came the drugs and in came the psychedelic era. Garcia talked about the acid tests the band started playing at. The acid tests were a series of parties held by author Ken Casey in the San Francisco Bay Area during the mid-1960s, centered entirely around the use of and advocacy of LSD.
We were already, you know, like burning out on the professional level that was available to us about the time the acid test came to our attention. But we were already from Palo Alto. We all knew Kesey, and we all knew friends that of ours that were involved with him. We'd all taken acid ourselves, and so it seemed natural to go. We got invited, actually, to one of these parties. This was before they were acid tests, even. They were just parties. And we got invited to one of these parties. We went down there. We plugged all our stuff in and played for about a minute. And then we all freaked out. But we made a good impression on everybody in that minute, you know. So we were invited to the next one. And so we just started playing at these things. And they were great fun, and they were very liberating for us because, after all, I mean, we'd come to our like Sunday night shows, and after having spent the day stoned on acid up in the woods somewhere, and we'd come down to the bars and play, you know, Sunday night. It was like, you know, we were playing like sort of maliciously.
And you're listening to Jerry Garcia. He died this day in history in 1995. By the way, we don't advocate you take an LSD, but we're not going to leave these things out of the stories that make and shape men any more than we'll leave Jesus Christ out of Jackie Robinson's life story. We will not leave LSD out of the Grateful Dead's. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories, and you're listening to Dwight Yoakam's cover of Truckin'. And we're going to get to some of the great artists who covered some of the great work of Jerry Garcia, who didn't consider himself much of an artist, let alone much of a songwriter. Well, you're going to find out that a lot of people had a very different opinion about that. Some very serious songwriters, some of the best across so many different idioms and artistic styles. But now we want to get back to Jerry's voice himself and Jerry talking about and telling stories about Jerry. And here, Garcia tells a bizarre but entertaining story that took place in the Watts, California neighborhood after being up all night with Neil Cassidy, a major figure of the Beat Generation of the 1950s and the psychedelic and countercultural movements of the 1960s, when they ran into a stop sign while driving a bus.
We drove the bus over to the Watts Towers for a minute or two, and we got out and looked at them, you know, and we were, you know, it's dawn. We went over to Wavy Gravy's house, which was down in, like, oh, off of Western, you know, way the hell off somewhere funny in Los Angeles. And they had a little house, and we had the bus there, and a bunch of us are sitting on the lawn, and we're all kind of crunched from being up all night, stoned on acid. You know, it's like the dawn is Sunday morning now. The dawn, and the bus is parked across the street from our point of view. We're on the lawn, and it's Sunday morning early, and here's Neil, you know, and he's ripped his shirt off. He has no shirt on now. And now he's no shirt, no shoes, and these funky old chinos they always have, they're always like just about to fall off, you know. And he's, first of all, George Walker is driving the bus. So George is driving the bus. And Neil is like the guy directing him into the parking place, you know. You know, a little to the left, a little to the right. He's doing all with signals. And he directs him right into a stop sign, an arterial stop sign. It knocks it. It shears it off. Boom. And the stop sign falls down. So then Neil gets up. So then the bus is parked. But Neil gets up and he's got the stop sign, you know. And he's like kind of trying to put it, make it stand up, you know. And so he's there with this stop sign, and down the street come like two really straight little old ladies, you know, and they're on their way to church Sunday morning, you know. And here's Neil, he's like the cosmic village drunk, you know what I mean? He's like, and he's got the stop sign, you know, and they're trying not to see him, you know, and he's doing this whole series of kind of like, good morning, ma'am, you know, kind of pantomime, you know, this extravagant thing all the time with, he would kind of like stand up the stop sign and then walk away from it and it'd start to fall and he'd grab it just as I'm about to hit, you know, and all this stuff happening. It was like amazingly great. It was just beautiful, perfect timing, you know, and it's just extraordinarily beautiful, you know, and his the way his body moved, the way he looked and everything like that was just absolutely, his face is so expressive. He would go through millions of expressions, just millions of them. And just his whole body language and everything was so communicative. It was just amazing. It was I was dying. I thought I was going to die. It was so hilarious. It was absolutely perfect. You know, it was like a little silent movie, a silent ballet, you know, in the morning. It lasted about maybe a minute and a half, you know, 2 minutes, but it was perfect. You know, it was like a perfect moment. It was just great.
And by the way, this kind of irreverence, this was everything that we all came to know about Garcia. And by the way, what happened with the career of the band is that the counterculture in the Bay Area soon became mainstream and lifted the dead into the mainstream. So go figure. You never know when the counterculture becomes the culture. And by the way, Cash's rebuttal was actually, at the time, Cash became the countercultural figure. Go figure. And he used to be the countercultural figure who became the culture and then became the countercultural figure all over again. And that's the story of music very often. Go figure. Here's Jerry Garcia talking about going out into America on tour and how not everyone was quite ready to accept a traveling group of hippie freaks.
The audiences caught on. They always caught on. The people in the world, you know, were like, not here, you don't. You know, we walk into a Holiday Inn or, you know, some place to say, oh, no, you know, not here, you know. And that, we got that kind of reaction the first couple of years we were out, you know. It was like, because people were used to seeing freaks then, you know, and that was still a big novelty, you know. So that was fun for us because it was the last chance you had to shock people just by the way you looked, just by the way you were, you know. You didn't even have to think about it or work at it at all. You could just walk down the street and people would go, oh, my God, you know. That was fun. That was, we got in on the last of that, probably. The music, well, the Grateful Dead has always been like a very chancy musical experience. And back then, what we were doing had the nature of it was that some nights it would be just awful, and some nights it would be wonderful, you know. And if people caught us on an awful night, they went away going, "What was that?" You know. And if they caught us on a wonderful night, they enjoyed it and they came back again. You know, it's like totally a roll of the dice, you know, something we never had any control of. We still don't have any control over it, but now our bad nights are accomplished. You know, now we can at least sound decent. You know, if we're not experiencing authentic inspiration. If we're experiencing authentic inspiration, then something magical sort of takes over. But if we're not, now we can at least sound professional, you know, it's in tune, you know, everything is like it's supposed to be, you know, it's an okay performance.
And by the way, this band would go on to sell over 35 million albums worldwide. And the band would take home $52 million from their farewell concert tour alone. The Wall Street Journal had once written them up as the world's most efficient corporation. Go figure, you're listening to the man who, by all accounts, led that band. Only in America, folks. Garcia talks here about how the band always had trouble picking what songs to play, how they decided who played what instrument, and how in the end he didn't think anything he'd written could be considered art.
We've always had a problem with deciding what to play. We've never been able to decide what to play at all. You know, so back then we were much more free form because we just were not able to decide what to play. So somebody would just start something, and the way we've handled it since then is that we still can't decide what to play, but but now at least we have a lot of stuff to choose from. It's one of those things. It's a default situation, you know what I mean? It's like somebody in the band's got to, you know, it's like one of those things where, well, who's going to play bass? The guy that plays guitar, worst. That's the way it is in most bands, you know. There's like certain things. So the writing songs got it was a default thing, you know. But all of us do some writing, so that I didn't ever felt that bad about it. But for me, it's one of those things like a craft. You know, it's like throwing a pot, you know. It's a craft. You there's a certain craft to it. It's not, for me, I don't know whether my songwriting rises to the level of art. There's one or two songs I think I've written, and Hunter and I have written, that I think are truly wonderful. And, but, you know, whether anybody else thinks that, I don't know.
Well, Elvis Costello, Los Lobos, Dwight Yoakam, Jane's Addiction, and Lyle Lovett decided to record some of their favorite Grateful Dead songs, and they would only say to Jerry, "We humbly disagree." Let's take a listen to Lyle Lovett's cover of a song he wished he'd written, "Friend of the Devil."
From Reno, I was trailed by 20 hounds. I didn't get to sleep that night till the morning came around. I set out running, but I take my time. A friend of the devil is a friend of mine. If I get home before daylight, I just might get some sleep tonight. Ran into the devil and he loaned me 20 bills. I spent the night in Utah in a cave up in the hills. I set out running, but I take my time. A friend of the devil is a friend of mine. If I get home before daylight, I just might get some sleep tonight.
And here in this last clip, in this celebration of Jerry's life, and that's Jerry Garcia, who died on this day in history in 1995. And by the way, pick up that record and listen to the rest of that story, because it's a story song, like a great Guy Clark song. Jerry goes on here to describe the people in the Grateful Dead as pathologically anti-authoritarian, which, by the way, made them quintessentially American, and how this is what formed the sound they created.
The people in the Grateful Dead are pathologically anti-authoritarian. So So it's just, you know, nobody can tell anybody what to do ever under any circumstances. So so that produces a certain amount of... also, if you ask somebody to play something, they'll never play it. So it produces a kind of music by confluence, you know, or by friction, or by opposites, by you know, it's conflicted. And that makes it interesting. It has a great deal of tension, you know, because everybody plays so differently from each other. I mean, it's like nothing on this earth will make me play like Bob. You know, nothing on this earth will ever make me play like Bob, and I'll be damned if I'm going to play like Phil. You know what I mean? It's like, you know what I mean? It's one of those kind of things. Each one of us experiences some version of that, you know. And it's just, it's not even something we consciously do. We just do it. It's like, it's as pure as mother's milk. You know what I mean? It's pure innocence.
Indeed. And that's, I think, what people responded to right there. This is Lee Habib, Unfettered. We try to get it as straight as possible. Jerry Garcia, a life in words, in his own words and his music, as we go out. This day in history, Jerry Garcia died in 1995.
Just crossed my mind.